And good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, whatever the case may be, wherever you are, around this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition, and tonight it's a really special edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical place between dusk and dawn where, well, tonight we're going to blow your socks off, so Walmart, get ready, because there's a whole bunch of people going to be coming in with tattered socks, and they will need replacements. I mean, we've had some really stunning shows. We've had epic shows. We've had amazing guests and all that. But I think tonight we're going to break a record because there have been so many discoveries that we have made this week between last weekend and tonight that we're, you know, going through tonight. And they connect all kinds of dots. I mean, it's kind of like a grand version of Trump's saying, and I really kind of fall in love with it. When he talks about the weave, boy, are we going to be weaving things together tonight. Things you wouldn't imagine in 100 years would be connected, and they are, and we can prove it. And anyway, so let me kind of get started. First of all, we are now in the wake of two major catastrophic death-dealing hurricanes, which struck the United States continental landmass within 2 weeks of each other, Helene and, of course, Milton. At the top, in our first item, I've had Keith repost the first link from last weekend for how to give to Hurricane Helene relief. It's also Hurricane Milton relief, so, I mean, you don't have to worry about the title, but click on that. That will give you a panoply of agencies. They're all reputable. They're all first class. I'm very partial to World Country Kitchen because those guys are doing astonishing work all over the world, particularly in devastated Gaza and in the West Bank and all other trouble spots. I mean, these people show up and they are giving people desperately needed nutritious food. And they've got an incredible team spirit. So, you know, they're on the list. There's a whole bunch of others, AmeriCare, and just go through the list. And whatever you can give, those agencies will make sure it gets on the ground that is coordinated with the FEMA efforts and with the governors. And, you know, I have family, of course, in South and North Carolina. And I think we're up now to third generation. The reason I know that is we also had a terrible tragedy during Helene. My sister's husband's granddaughter, Anna Marie, was killed a couple weeks ago when a tree fell on her house, and there was nothing that could be done. It was instantaneous, and it just reminds you that, you know, if you think you're not touched by what's going on, at some point you will be, which means we all need empathy. If we're incredibly lucky and living under the providence of God or whatever, that, you know, these things have not touched us yet, but at some point the clock will run out. So give to that first link whatever you can give. And for those of you who are new to The Other Side of Midnight, remember, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our URL. And if you're listening to us, you're probably listening on that on your phone. And then you click on the banner, the huge radar, you know, false color image of Hurricane Helene, and that will take you to the guest page. And on the guest page, you'll see right under it where it says fast links to items with my name and David and Andrew, and there'll be a fourth one there. Greg is going to have an item or two. And then under that, you'll see links to bios. So if you want a more complete biography of the guests tonight, you go to that. I'm going to do very abbreviated bios because we have so much to get through, so much. This is really dangerous. You know, back when Art Bell conned me into doing this, oh gosh, Art, you know, and I've now been doing this for 9 years. I can't believe it's been 9 years. Anyway, we've got a lot of amazing shows. They're all in the archive. If you join Club 19.5, you've got thousands of hours to listen to. And if you're new to the show, you probably should really try to go and listen to some of the archives, because they are a kind of a memory of what we have done and who we have done it with. And the scope of our subject matter has ranged the gamut, science to politics to, I'm having a problem with my headset here. I wonder why. Let me see. Let me do one thing here. Okay. Yeah, it's weird. And just when I was going on the air, why is it doing that? Anyway, I can now hear. You know, electronics in the desert should last forever, and they don't. You've got to basically give them exercise. Otherwise, they do very funny things. They, when you're dealing with potentiometers, that's those rotary, you know, volume dials. They get dull spots. They get corrosion where the electricity does not transmit in the pot or the potentiometer. So anyway, exercise your pots once a week. That'll be my, tip for the week, you know, important memo to self. Anyway, these hurricanes are just coming at us left and right. And there was the most remarkable comment by someone who, of course, I don't agree with on anything, except in this case, as we're going to prove to you tonight, she's absolutely right. This is Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is part of the Trump coterie of the Republican House of Representatives in 2024. And she said a few days ago that there was, in her mind or in her sources or whatever, absolutely, you know, crystal clear information that these hurricanes have been controlled and aimed. Now, of course, she's blaming the Biden folks, and they're clueless. I guarantee you that 99.99% of the Biden administration, up to and including maybe the president himself, are totally clueless. This is really deep state information that going back to the 1950s, the U.S. government in its deepest recesses were experimenting with ameliorating and ultimately controlling hurricanes. No one seems to know that. It was called Project Storm Fury. Look it up. Google is your friend. And, of course, they were using cloud seeding techniques, and there were all kinds of tests, and they actually, with the hurricane hunters, they would go out over the Atlantic or over the Gulf with storms that date back to very famous storms in the 50s and 60s, and they would try to seed one side of the eye wall. You know, remember, hurricanes are huge rotating vortices with winds depending upon the velocity clocked from Category 1 to Category 5 on the Saffir-Simpson scale, one being just at 75 mile an hour winds, five being, I think it's 175 miles per hour. But there were hurricanes like Andrew that totally blew past Category 5 and did things that hurricanes are not supposed to be able to do, which, if someone will remind me, when we get into the physics of how you control a hurricane, and we're going to get into that tonight, absolutely, because if someone gave me enough money, and we're talking, you know, billions, I could control a hurricane. And I'm not the only one. I'm going to read to you some passages from a very important book which came out several years ago from my departed friend, Paul LaViolette, who had a PhD in systems science. He basically was a generalist, and this was a PhD in being a generalist. And he wrote a book called Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, which, if I look at the pub date here, I can tell you when this came out. It's published by our friends at Bear & Company, which may be the publishers of one of my latest books. This was published in 2008, 16 years ago, by Paul LaViolette, and it's got updates that you're going to... Anyway, we will get to that because, yes, we know, meaning the human race, know how to control hurricanes. And I'm really wondering if the president is totally clueless, because this is one of those really ultimate secrets that if you're part of a deep state that has continuity between administration and administration and administration, particularly in the intelligence areas, it's not the kind of thing that you might want to share with a guy who's only there for 4 years and then may be there for another four and may not, but his term limited to 2 terms. And, you know, he's kind of like a renter. He doesn't really own the government. You know, it's supposed to be every 2 years we pick a new guy or new gal, in the case may be. So when Biden looks in the camera and says, you know, this is ridiculous, I really believe him, because this has been very, very deeply stunning technological information. And the only reason that I know about it is because a friend of mine, Paul, did a hell of a job of deep diving and finding data going all the way back to Tesla, which obviously to some of you is not going to be a major surprise. So that's going to be the end of the 3 hours, where we wrap all this weaving together. And I show you that the idea of the documented control we're going to show earlier in the evening on these two recent catastrophic storms is not, in fact, accidental. And there appear to be good guys and bad guys. There appear to be bad guys trying to use them as weapons. And I'm going to show you evidence that the good guys actually were able to intervene, particularly with Milton at the last minute, and decrease it drastically, as well as shift its track. So the worst case scenario, you know, tidal surges, storm surges of 15 to 20 feet, that kind of thing, did not pile up in the landlocked Tampa Bay, which would have really resulted in far more fatalities, far more destruction, far more long-term damage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we literally were experienced an invisible weather war, and it's been happening over the last two hurricanes, and we have data tonight that for any reasonable person, when you see the evidence, the only conclusion you can come to is, yes, somebody was really, you know, effing around with us. And someone else leaped in as defenders and changed what could have been cataclysmic to just incredibly tragic and sad for the 17 people in Florida who so far, and the number could still rise, lost their lives in the Milton event. So moving on, and then we'll get back to the hurricanes as part of the show momentarily. While all this is going on Earth, there is an amazing celestial event, an apparition occurring overhead, beginning tonight, early tomorrow morning. This is my link number 2, which is from the BBC, How to Spot the Comet of the Century in UK Skies. Well, luckily, the latitude, north latitude of the United Kingdom and the United States are pretty much the same. You know, it doesn't go that much farther south. So the instructions you'll find in item number 2 pretty much applies to the continental United States and to Hawaii and to our friends in Canada you know, anywhere else around this northern latitude band. This is a comet. Let me actually give you the name. Now, I'm probably going to blow this. It's called Comet A3 Tsutsunshan Atlas. Tsutsunshan is obviously the discoverer. Atlas is the technology that was used. There is this worldwide network that NASA maintains in with observatories and telescopes on all the major continents, and they're part of this so-called Atlas network. The Atlas name is actually an acronym, which stands for asteroid something or other, having to do with early warning, because, of course, one of the really important problems of our age is do we have the technology to go out and basically change the trajectories of asteroids so they don't hit the Earth and cause calamities that would be, you know, 1,000 times worse than a hurricane, particularly if you're near ground zero. So the Atlas Network, which, by the way, is the same telescope array which in August 7th, detected this little asteroid that it's our mini moon now, from the 29th of September to, we are told, the 25th of November. We have a little mini moon estimated to be only 30, 40 or so feet across. That number is an estimate. We don't really know the size, because the only way this thing is even detectable in the world's largest telescopes is as a twink, as a point of light, as a pixel. And so everything we're learning is in terms of spectroscopy or light curves, watching how that little twink goes up and down in brightness, which gives you the rotation of the object. These are very fast-spinning objects. I mean, they're part of, so we are told, of a larger, very sparsely populated asteroid belt co-equal with the Earth Moon's orbit of the Sun. I bet you didn't know we had an asteroid belt at the Earth's distance from the Sun. You thought it hung out between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Well, you learn something new every day. This is called the Arjuna asteroid belt, after a very famous Indian personage who was a warrior, who was a musician, who was a dancer. That's going to come into the conversation tonight. Boy, I do sound like Trump. It's all going to come together. Wait till you see how it all comes together. Anyway, beginning at dawn in the Northern Hemisphere tomorrow morning, some hours after we get off the air, at 3 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, if you look to the east before sunrise, about half an hour, a little more than half an hour before the sun comes up, you will spot this object, and it will move further away from the sun as the days progress. It should be visible from tomorrow morning to, let me scan down this thing here, to well into October. I'm not quite sure, but it's going to be visible for like at least a week, if not longer, maybe a week and a half. So you might want to watch it, because according to the experts, the last time this little guy visited the inner solar system, 80,000 years ago. So it really is a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime apparition, and there's nothing really more thrilling than going out with your real eyeballs. Don't go to the computer. Don't go to the internet. Don't go to Sleuth and all that. Go out with your eyeballs and a pair of binoculars and try to see this thing for real, because it will connect you to the fact that we're part of a much larger cosmic panoply. I almost said soap opera, and as you'll see later in the morning, there are aspects of this that really, really are kind of like a soap opera. Okay, that brings me to item number three. We're going to focus now on the hurricanes and Marjorie Taylor Greene's outlandish, outrageous, assertion that these were controlled. And damn it, she's right. Now, her reasons for thinking that, and her idea of the objectives, the goals, is totally nuts. No. This is not to keep Republicans in red states from voting. No, this is so much bigger. And toward the end of the 3 hours, I'm going to bring up some evidence with David Sarita, that corroborates my ultimate model of what is going on with Trump and why should we be interested. It turns out that our former president has a very interesting secret set of knowledge, which he has now published. So everybody's going to get a chance to look at it simultaneously. And I got to say, it's so damn elegant. All right, so let's begin the story. Before we do that, let me introduce our guests. Our guests tonight are David Sarita. David is he's a hyperdimensional technologist. He is another generalist, but he's been working on devices and technologies for healing, for energy, for communication, which basically work with this physics that I have been talking about for decades. He is with us. We've got Andrew Curry, who, as you know, has a master's in art therapy, is a professional artist. He does work for major movies. He does work for, you know, commercial enterprises, not just in Canada, but in the United States and, frankly, probably other countries. I haven't followed in detail, you know, all his clients. But he's worked on, for instance, commercials that have appeared and won awards on the Super Bowl. And the reason he is with us tonight is because he and I have been talking back and forth this week and sharing the most amazing discoveries and implications and all that. So, of course, he had to be on the show tonight. We've got Georgia Lambert with us, who is our resident metaphysician. Again, what you want to do is you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com and, oh, I see that Georgia's bio is not up there. Well, it will be in the next few minutes, so just keep checking back. And her full bio, which goes on for many, many, many pages and is very interesting. The most important thing of relevance to our discussion tonight is that she worked with Manly Hall at the Institute there in Los Angeles for many years, about 10 years. He wrote what I call the 25-pound doorstop, which is this mega book making references and cross-correlations with all kinds of metaphysicians and metaphysical information, ancient, you know, textual sources, et cetera, et cetera. And he really rose to fame for collating all of this in the 1940s and 50s. And Georgia had the good fortune of being one of the in crowd. And so a lot of her training was at the hands of a master. And, you know, Georgia, at some point you might want to say a few more tidbits about Manly Hall. Or not, you know, it's all dependent. Now, last but not least is our friend and colleague, Greg Ahrens. Greg is an Air Force veteran. He is a citizen scientist. He worked with me initially on the apparition of the amazing Norway spiral and has now mastered some of the more intricate, you know, arcanery of a program called Stellarium, which is kind of like the computer equivalent of the best damn computer that the U.S. government had back in the 1940s and 50s, run by a guy named Vannevar Bush. So now we can do things that only the big guys could have done even decades ago, and anyone can learn how to use the software and to ask the right questions and get the most important answers. And so Greg is going to be part of the show when we get into some of the numbers. So let me start with Helene, which was the hurricane which tracked up from between the Yucatan and Cuba. I believe it started on the 23rd of September, if my memory serves. And it tracked all the way up across the so-called, you know, Big Bend region of Florida, came ashore as a Cat 4, went inland across Georgia, across Atlanta, and then it turned west and stalled on the weekend of the 27th to 29th over western North Carolina, where, as I said, I have family, and it wound up killing Anna Marie among hundreds of people. There's almost 100 people who were killed by the flash floods and the topography and the overwhelming rain. I mean, again, it's not the wind that kills you if you're inland during a hurricane. It's the rain and the flash flooding. And something like 18 inches of rain fell from Helene over northwestern Carolina, North Carolina, in about 24 hours. So, you know, this is catastrophic. When Milton came ashore in Florida 2 weeks later, just a few days ago, they had like 10 inches of rain over the Tampa, St. Petersburg area in about 24 hours. And at the height, over a period of 1 hour, they had over 5 inches of rain. Again, if you feel these things are kind of unprecedented, they are. And the reason is, of course, global climate change, global warming. Warmer waters over which hurricanes form and it provides the fuel is basically dependent on evaporation of water. The higher temperature of the Gulf now is at about 80 or 81 degrees Fahrenheit. It would be a beautiful place to take a swim because it's really, really warm, except that warm water, that basin of warm water, nurtures hurricanes, and we've now had two of them that were spawned in the Gulf and came ashore and have caused loss of life and incredible property damage and all kinds of, you know, collateral effects. And they both originated within 2 weeks in the Gulf. Now, I've not had time to go back and look and see if any other hurricanes, either in the last few years or in the decades previous, formed so close to each other and came ashore so in a short interval of time and did so much damage. But of course, that's all in some archive somewhere. So if someone in our audience can go and take a look and maybe send an email or on Skype, you know, send us a note, or, you know, there's lots of ways to communicate with the show. So let me bring up item number four, because this is the history of Helene, which began on the 23rd and kind of sat for a while on the weekend of the 27th to 29th over the western part of North Carolina, which of course is listed there. It's the X marks where it went north from North Carolina and then went into Tennessee and then into across the Kentucky and then Tennessee. And so there was major loss of life in the southeast, all from the storm, just kind of sitting and spinning and raining out an incredible amount of water. What you want to focus on in that map, which comes from NOAA, is where Helene originated, at 19.5 degrees. Now, this is not abnormal. Other hurricanes historically, there's a belt kind of between 19.5 north, 20, 21. You remember, these are windows, not exact lines, where hurricanes can form. For some reason, hurricanes don't seem to form in the southern hemisphere. There has been extraordinarily rare hurricane events. One a few years ago that went ashore in Brazil, but compared to the northern hemisphere, they do not have any real hurricane activity in the southern hemisphere. And we're now at the bottom of the hour, so we will take a break. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Thank you.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, October 12th, 2024. Tonight, we're talking control of hurricanes. And before I proceed further with this background, let me bring everybody on and see if my guests tonight have any comments of what we've discussed so far.
Yes, Richard.
David Sarita. Our hyperdimensional technology.
I want to point out in my item, if you go to my items, you go to my item 5, which is my double vortex scalar coil, which is a sacred cubit diameter, which is 25 inches. It's a really big coil. There is this. I'm going to demonstrate some evidence on how you can cancel out the spin of a hurricane, because when I did this transmission,
Back up. What transmission?
Yeah, remember, just before the big solar storm, this coil is a transmitter antenna, but it's a vortex, just like a hurricane is a vortex. Now, if you see what I'm going to present, you'll understand how this will support the theory that you can generate or cancel. You just got to spin the opposite direction of the hurricane, and you can severely weaken it. So when I transmitted this 2 times, I got the same results.
Slow down. When did you build this thing?
I just built this recently, actually. I built it about a month ago.
And why did you build it?
Well, I build coils. I mean, if you go to my website, davidsarita.co, I've been selling coil systems for therapy and altering consciousness for years. I mean, for 20 years.
Okay.
So
people probably don't know that, so we have to fill in the blank.
Yeah, no, I don't think we've talked about my technology much. Remember, I was appointed director of the Tesla Foundation by Bogdan Castle-Magwitch, who is a MIT PhD and was building nuclear fusion machines in the 90s. And I worked with him and, of course, you know, Glenn Seaborg and Murray Gell-Mann and many other brilliant physicists were part of the Advanced Physics Corporation in Irvine, California, and New Jersey also doing this.
And Glenn Seaborg was head of the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, several decades ago.
Right. And I met him. I had great conversations with him, which we could deviate on. But listen to what happened. So the night of when we were all waiting, there was an X9 solar flare.
All waiting for what?
For a solar tsunami. And the X9
Hang on. Because I wasn't waiting for anything like this. You have to give the backstory. Don't skip over points. We have 3 hours. Come on.
Okay, so you if you go to spaceweather.com, you will see when the sun in its current peak cycle, sunspot cycle, releases a plasma wave, a flare, which can be an M flare, an X flare. The X flares are the biggest classification of flares we have. So in this current cycle, remember last summer when we had, you know, the sky was turning pink and green and everybody
mm-hmm.
was excited
mm-hmm.
because there were these X4s that left the sun, right?
Well, what the flares do is they trigger something called a CME, a coronal mass ejection, which is flung out into space from the sun. And depending upon the geometry, at times it can interact with the Earth's magnetic field. And then the particles get dumped down the field lines, and you can get auroras all the way down to my latitude or even southern Texas or northern Mexico. But it has to require a very large coronal mass ejection, and those only really occur during the peak of the sunspot cycle. Are we in the peak of 24 or 25?
No, we're in the peak of the cycle. In fact, the sun should have already flipped by now. It should have flipped its poles and ended the cycle, but it hasn't.
You mean the magnetic poles?
Yeah, the magnetic poles are way overdue to flip. They haven't done that.
Ah.
Right. So what's coming in when a when you're getting auroras, what's coming in first when you get the flare, so you get an X flare or an M flare, the first part of the flare travels at the speed of light. So it causes radio blackouts on the Earth very quickly.
Yeah, those are the X-rays. They're not particles.
Yeah,
electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah, and so when you're getting auroras, you're getting both ions, which is an atom with a net negative or positive charge on it, and then you get electrons that stream down and interact with the atmosphere to produce the glow. So my coil is spinning a magnetic field at 3/4 the speed of light at about 150 watts, and it's going straight up like a column in all directions at the speed of light. And so
when you say it's going straight up, does it have a beam width?
Oh yeah, no. You can. This. It's if you could see the field coming off this thing. I mean, I've got meters to measure it.
Right.
It's going right out into space at the speed of light. So that would theoretically.
Hold on. Slow down, David. Please. Mm-hmm. How wide is the beam? Like, think of it like a searchlight beam. Is it narrow? Is it wide? Does it cover the entire sky?
Well, theoretically, the center of the vortex, just like a hurricane, is the calm point. And as you get wider out into the field is where the spin gets more intense. So it does create a beam, which is in the center. And that's going clearly into space infinitely, so there really is no end to it.
So this is an invisible radio swirling vortex electromagnetic signal in a relatively narrow searchlight type beam. You're aiming it directly at the zenith overhead, right?
Yes, but it's kind of the shape of the coil's concave, so it's going to fan out so the disk will get bigger and bigger and bigger the higher up it goes. And in response to this, there were no
Wait, you're leaping again. In response to what? What did you do?
I transmitted two frequencies. One is equal to the orbit of our mini moon visitor,
Arjuna
5329. And the second frequency, remember, there's two coils here. It looks like one coil, but there's two right on top of each other.
Right.
One is spinning clockwise, and one is spinning counterclockwise.
Ah.
What does that do? Torsion. It creates scalar because it creates a cancellation effect. So the second coil is transmitting the orbital period of Earth, 365.256. And the other coil is transmitting 53.29, which we'll get into later. And when I transmit, the storm that was supposed to arrive from the X9 flare, this is before the October 10th auroras that made a spectacle all over the world. Pictures were coming in from everywhere, including Texas.
Yeah, a couple
people
nights ago.
Yeah, so there's two of them. I did two tests. So the first test I did, they called the solar storm a dud, meaning they thought the X9 should have produced a massive display of auroras, and it produced nothing.
Now,
what
date was this?
Okay, well, I don't have the date right in front of me. It's actually just before. It was only like a week before October
10th. Oh, okay.
10th.
Well, so we're in the relatively recent time frame.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is very, very, very recent.
People
so
don't
when I
know
run
that.
The coil,
unless, David, people don't know anything unless you tell them. Don't skip intervening bits. Please.
Right. So what happens really kind of blew my mind, because if you go to my item 6, the way auroras display themselves, they usually, most of the images you see on space weather, and you can go to the spaceweather.com gallery to see these, are raining colors and streaks. But what happened when I ran the coil only 20 minutes later, straight above the coil, which is above my house.
So wait, the coil is aimed directly up at the zenith?
Yeah, it's going straight up.
Is it on a rotating platform? Can you move it to the horizon? or at an angle or east?
Oh, I can tilt it at any angle I want, just
okay.
like an antenna.
So on this experiment, you had it aimed straight up, and you sent these two frequencies. At what time and for how long?
Well, I ran it for about an hour, and then at about just after 9 o'clock, the auroras exploded straight above my house. And in fact, it looked like a vortex. In fact, if you go to the third photograph on my item 6, you can see a pink vortex merging with a whiter light green vortex in the middle. They're counter-rotating. Now you can actually see it in the photograph. And that's exactly what my coils are doing. So I'm showing, because the auroras are made from electron and ion streams, and my coil is transmitting an electric and magnetic field which will manipulate ions, and therefore it's responding beautifully, because nowhere else in both experiments did I see this phenomenon straight up. I mean, straight above the coil. Because the other photos, okay, so experiment two, running the same frequencies, was just before October 10th. And again, somewhere around 10 o'clock at night is when it got really amazing on the 10th of October, coming into the 11th. The same thing happened, but it was straight above my house. And if I look on Space Weather, there's only a few people anywhere that saw the vortex like ripping right out of the sky. And Richard, it was pulsing. It was like the lights, you know, flickering lights in the house. The auroras were going flash, 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 flash. And they did this.
Wait, you mean they were blinking in code?
They were blinking and coded. I was trying to videotape the blinking, but my iPhone camera, the iPhone 15 Pro Max, couldn't capture in video mode light levels that low, but it was literally blinking and coded. And I'm going, I'm missing this. It's literally going, it's like dots and dashes, the actual auroras.
Okay, let me ask some more questions. Yes. What was the interval of time between you transmitting and you getting this response of an aurora right over your house?
Well, again, it's 20 minutes, so response time. So when I started, nothing's happening. The sky is black.
Right.
And then 20 minutes later, and remember, the first experiment, the response to the X9 was a dud. There's hardly anybody that saw this, except for in my region, which is just north of northern Idaho on the Canadian side. I'm in this Kootenai region of lakes and mountains is where I am. So most of the photos that you see out there look like my fourth photo, where you just see pink and green streaks raining down. The vortex that exploded above me lasted for, I would say, an hour and a half.
Now, did you continuously transmit, or did you transmit and stop waiting for an answer?
I transmitted, and it started during the transmission, and then I turned it off. Yes, I turned it off, and it just seemed to be, it's like an attraction response. It makes so much sense if you understand electromagnetism and a spinning vortex.
So
and
you're
a hurricane.
Thinking that the energy, 150 watts is nothing. That's a light bulb.
Yeah, but you understand
Hang on. So you're transmitting on basically a very weak signal. You transmit for 20 minutes, and then toward the end, you get this incredible aurora right above the transmitter in a vortex pattern, and nobody else anywhere on the planet is seeing this.
No, nobody but my town saw this. I got, okay, in the second aurora batch, which was the 10th of October, starting in about 9:30, 10 o'clock, the only photographs I saw in Space Weather that looked like the explosion straight above, like it literally looked like a vortex. I mean, the pictures don't really do it justice. The center of the vortex was straight above the house. So the only photographs I saw that look like this are from my town of Nelson, British Columbia, and also the Yukon, which is right above me, which would only, you know, from looking straight up in the sky at the same time at night.
When
the
Yukon, you say above you, you mean north of you.
No, no, this is straight up.
No, you said the Yukon is above you. You mean north
of
you.
Well, the Yukon is north of me.
Good, okay.
What they would see in the sky would be, what I'm seeing would just be a slight tilt angle to the south for them, right?
Mm.
So, again, looking at pictures all over the United States and the world, they're on space weather. There are only a few locations that would have been around the same north latitude as me that would have seen this. And not just north latitude, your cross section, your north and south latitude. So you've got to see how rare this would have been. Because I was really critical. I mean, as an experimenter and a scientist and someone who's been building experiments for years, I've built a lot of machines and a lot of magnetic field generators. This, I was really critical, because if everybody saw these explosions straight up, not at an angle, straight up, then I wouldn't have been that impressed. But I realized, when you were talking about hurricanes in the beginning, of course, my coil is shaped like a hurricane. And if you, and why only 150 watts is so responsive? When, you know, when you use walkie-talkies and you're in a mountainous region, you're not going to get good reception very far, like maybe a mile and a half. But if you're out on a lake, you're going to get reception for miles, actually. And so when you're transmitting straight up, like I'm doing, there's nothing in the way. So that means all of the ions, which are your charged atoms, are going to respond like little magnetic poles. So they're going to respond to my magnetic spinning field. So it's the same with a hurricane. There's nothing else up. So if you had huge coils, and I even have bigger ones than this, I mean, this particular one I designed to be a sacred cubic
diameter.
Okay,
we don't have infinite time. So let me collapse this, because I want to get back to the hurricane story, and then we'll come back to this. But you're you're saying if you had a bigger antenna, much bigger and much more powered,
same design,
but much bigger and powered by many more watts. Let's say a megawatt. Let's say something on the order of HARP. The HARP.
No, I don't need a megawatt, Richard. No, I don't think I need anywhere near that.
For you to control a hurricane.
Yeah, I just spin it the other way, and I'll weaken the hurricane. I'll make it slow down, because it's spinning.
Well, there's
one
some
direction.
Obviously power level where it will work, and below that it won't have much of an effect. Because
that's right. Yeah, there's some, and we'd have to experiment on that.
Well, we don't want to experiment that way. Thank you. No. This has to be very carefully done. All right, let me go back to what I'm, you know, talking about, because this is going to hook all together. Not too far from now. So you want to go to my item. Remember, we were on item 4. Helene starts at 19.5. I went to Google because I couldn't believe my measurements. You know, I'm always distrusting my own work, because that's how you have to do science. I went to Google, and the little AI popped up, and it said to my question, which you see at the top, Tropical Storm Helene Center. That's when it goes from just random thunderstorms to a coherent rotating vortex. A tropical storm is a precursor to a hurricane, which gets stronger. And then it's defined as a hurricane when the winds are above 74 miles per hour. It says was located at latitude 19.5 north when it became a tropical storm. So that's pretty damn interesting. So now we go to number 6. Because that turned out to be, if you look at 4, that hurricane wandered up and finally sat over North Carolina, western part, killing people over Tennessee, killing people on the 29th of September, which brings us to Greg's items, Greg's Aruna alignments. If you click on that, the little guy that's currently orbiting the Earth went into horseshoe orbit around the Earth at 19.54 universal coordinated time on Sunday the 29th, at the same time that Hurricane Helene is sitting over North Carolina dumping all that water. So then the question is, was this just a coincidence, or is it in fact somehow a correlation? So that brings us to number seven, which is Milton, which formed well north of 19.5 on October 5th, but that's coordinated with, as you're going to see a connection, Donald Trump returned to Butler Meridian, Pennsylvania on October 5th and held a rally. You know, this time, remember, he had been shot there a couple of months before on the 13th of July, and he didn't have these shields, these bulletproof shields. This shows you how the Secret Service ramped up protection so he could, in fact, be protected from any, you know, stray bullets or whatever that somebody in the crowd or outside the fence or perimeter could bring to bear. The question, of course, everybody, including me, started with is, why did Trump go back to the scene of the crime? I'm going to show you it was not a coincidence. So that takes us to number eight. Nine. This is a NOAA image of Helene just off the coast of Milton, just off the coast of Florida, just before it made landfall. Remember, it strengthened so dramatically that there was a meteorologist in Miami, whose name escapes me, who was on live television when he got the report from NOAA as to the strengthening several days before landfall. And he looked at the readout and he broke into tears because he knew that a lot of people were going to die by simply looking at the data, because apparently in 10 hours, the central pressure of the tropical storm turned hurricane fell by something like 50 millibars, which is stunningly unprecedented. And one of the reasons, I'm sure, why Marjorie Taylor Greene thought that somebody might be messing with it. Well, she was right. And I can tell you toward the end of the show this morning how you make a pressure in the center of a hurricane, you know, go that low that fast. And it's amazing. The technology has been within our grasp, separate from David's experiments, since back in the 1950s. Nobody knows about it because they're not supposed to know about it. Item number 10. This now is a close-up. I had a much better map, but for some reason, when I went to the map this afternoon, it had all been taken down, showing the hour interval real-time track of Hurricane Milton across Florida. This is the best I could do. You click on it, it gets bigger. What we're going to talk about is that little jog when it gets to the east coast of Florida. It came ashore at 8:30 East Coast time on, I believe, the night of the 7th. Greg, am I right about that? Greg? Greg Ahrens? Oh, you're muted.
Okay, yeah. Milton came ashore on the 9th.
On the 9th, okay. And let me click on
8:30 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, I'm not seeing a link to your items. But that could be because I have to refresh my screen.
It may be.
Which I've just done.
Keith was working on fixing something else, and then he was going to get these up.
Well, all right. We'll post them later. Just read it from your sheet there or whatever. When did Milton come ashore on the 9th?
The 9th of October at 8:30 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. And then you got some correlations because I asked you to look for stellar alignments on the assumption that this thing was controlled and there would be stellar alignments other places on the planet if this was part of some hyperdimensional ritual. And you found what?
Okay. I found it. Let's see. Aldebaran is just about, just a little bit under, 39 degrees and change below the north-northeast.
Okay, and Aldebaran is the brightest star in the constellation of Taurus.
And represents Set.
Which represents Set in the Egyptian mythology.
the bad guy brother of Horus or something. Anyway.
And 39 is twice 19.5.
9.5, right.
Now, wait, where was it at that position? What?
Oh, from Sarasota, Florida.
Ah, which is right where the hurricane came ashore.
Came ashore, yeah.
Holy cow!
From Jerusalem, Regulus was minus 18 degrees and 3 minutes, but about 5 minutes earlier, it was at minus 19.5.
Hmm.
And around, let's see, who else is here? The Orion Belt stars were 30 degrees, 31 degrees, 32 degrees above the east southeast.
From
Jerusalem.
Okay.
Then jumping down to Giza, let's see. Okay, those are not really significant.
Okay.
From Washington, D.C., Regulus was minus 19.5 degrees below west-northwest. And also, when this landfall occurred, Regulus, which is the heart of the lion and represents Horus, I think.
Right.
Anyway, Regulus was conjunct with Mercury.
Okay.
And then I looked at Moscow. And the belt stars of Orion were at, well, close to 19.5. One was 19 degrees and 6 minutes, and one was 20 degrees and 18 minutes. That was okay. And then, let's see, from Beijing, Sirius was plus 32 degrees above the southwest horizon. And then about 5 or 10 minutes earlier was at plus 33 degrees above the southwest horizon.
So within the window, we're getting multiple alignments out of a 24-hour sky. It's like you're kind of like trying to thread the needle where you make a best fit for all these disparate but very important political or ancient sacred sites. And the hurricane is coming ashore at 8:30 exactly, just south of Tampa, right?
Well, that's the time that they gave us. It's the official time.
Breaks down.
But as it's coming in over a little island off the shore, the thing is, so the eye is so many miles around, and I don't know how they...
Okay, we are at the top of the hour. We will come back to this. A lot to cram in tonight. So what I'm building here is a case for you can't make all of these alignments, all of these hits, all of these correlations with something really, really random. This is not random. This is a pattern. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, October the 12th of 2024. A lot of information to put together and process, and I'm trying to orchestrate something which is kind of almost bigger than the 3 hours we have, and you really never have enough time. So Greg, let me come back to you. Say again?
Oh, no, okay. Yeah, I was checking to see if I was unmuted or not.
Okay, good. Okay, let me stop this. Let me go back to this.
Oh, but what I was saying was the eye is so many miles across, and it came over a little island off the shore of Florida. And so, to precisely say a time that the eyeball, that the hurricane made landfall, is a little bit of a window itself.
Well, what they do is the NOAA people, the Weather Service people, the hurricane folks who are headquartered there in Miami, they basically use the radar to pinpoint the center of the circle of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, they're not timing it for when the eye wall first comes ashore, when the winds are highest and then they drop to nothing and you've got calm in the eye. And then the center slides across the geography, and that's when they say mark, and then the other side, the backside, at whatever speed the hurricane is moving, and this was moving like 16 miles per hour in a northeast direction, and then the back of the wall, the back of the eye comes across land, and then you get the reverse winds. So they're timing it from the center, not when the winds drop at the first touch of the eye wall, on land. So this is pretty accurate because they've got very accurate radar. What I want to point out at this point in our conversation is that this is all in terms of daylight savings time. So in fact, Hurricane Milton in normal time, standard time, came ashore at 19.5. Or if you look on daylight savings time, it came ashore at the same time, 7:30, which is 19.5, as Houston, Texas, and the NASA Manned Spacecraft Center, which will play a major role in our story in a little further along, okay? And keep it still working. Okay, so let me now go back to my items, and let's see, we'll pick up where I was, which means I have to scroll up. Okay.
I think you were at 10.
I was at 10. Now, if you look at 10, and you can actually do the control, scroll wheel to make it much, the track is bobbing and weaving. It's not straight like it was with Helene. It's going back and forth, and it's got little wiggles back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then look on the far right of Florida, where it makes that jog up and then jogs down. Everybody sees that, right? That's where Cape Canaveral is. So somehow this storm was aimed at Cape Canaveral and then diverted by being moved further north by a few miles. So the worst of the storm surge was to the north of Cape Canaveral, and then it goes back south again, and then it jogs north, and then it goes straight out, and that's where the X is a couple days after landfall. The same thing happened before it made landfall, in that instead of hitting in Tampa Bay with the right-hand side of the storm, which is the bad side when you're approaching land from the west, which would have piled a huge amount of water up in the cul-de-sac of Tampa Bay, They were able to, whoever is working this, were able to jog it just 19.5 19.5 miles south. Literally, 19.5 miles. So that it was to the south of Tampa, and the heavy part of the storm surge and all that, was Sarasota and points further south, and Tampa Bay dodged a real bullet. So yes, Marjorie, this damn storm was controlled, and you can see two forces trying to control it and decontrol it, control it, decontrol it, over and over and over again as the, time progressed. Let me move my cursor back here so I can see everything, which brings us to number 11. Number 11 is NOAA satellite imagery, wide angle, that's the top panel, and narrow. If you click on that, it takes you to a Facebook page. Get rid of the Facebook page thing with the X. You'll see the actual video, which, Keith did not have time yet to post as a direct video. But what this is time lapse of the storm rotating and all of the lightning that broke out on the eastern side of the storm that caused 102 tornado alerts before Milton made landfall, an unprecedented number before any hurricane in history that's been measured, according to the NOAA archives, as well as a large number of, I think there were 38 or 39 tornadoes, 39 twice 19.5, and they were up to a category on the Saffir-Simpson scale of 3, an F3 tornado, and they are rarely, if ever, seen in hurricanes, classical hurricanes, going back decades. You might have every fifth storm, you might have one or two, but here you had dozens of them in the space of a few hours as Milton was approaching the coast. And in my model, the defenders were furiously bombarding, you know, Milton with some kind of energy, causing it to slow its rotation to reduce the winds. I mean, did you notice that in the official archive, this hurricane was supposed to come ashore as a Cat 3? Well, that's winds above 120 miles an hour sustained. The maximum winds that were registered at when it came ashore was only 107 miles per hour. So it was basically down to a Cat 2 and falling even as it crossed because of all the efforts in my model to de-spin it, a la David and his idea of how you could do it, with his technology on a much larger scale, and the side effect, because remember, in three dimensions, you can't just magically make energy disappear. So if you have a rotating fluid, and a hurricane in the atmosphere is, in science terms, a fluid, and you de-spin it, that energy is going to go into creating many, many sub-vortices. Like take a cup of coffee and pour cream in it and then stir it backwards with a spoon and you'll see little mini vortices pop up. That's what I think we're seeing in terms of the visible effects, both in the lightning discharges, massive lightning bolts. Do you know how high voltage they have measured in both thunderstorms and hurricane thunderstorm lightning during these events? Over 1 billion volts. 1 billion volts discharged many times per second. You know, click on the rewind thingy and you'll see all these storms on this time lapse with their incredible voltage displays. I think this is all side effects of the efforts by the good guys to de-spin the hurricane, reduce the winds, reduce the damage, reduce the storm surge, et cetera. This is overwhelming, even if we didn't have the numbers, but we've got the numbers. Okay, let me stop there, and let me ask the rest of our panel tonight to weigh in with their ideas on what we have presented. Let's see, who do we want to start with? Andrew.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. You have the floor.
So, Richard, what you're saying with this, just to come back to your squiggly line going across Florida, is we're talking about a torsion duel.
Exactly. Either David's technology on a much bigger scale, or the technology I'm going to read about later from Paul's book toward the end of the program, which was worked with and made possible, developed, perfected back in the 1950s. And nobody knows about it until Paul wrote this book, which was, you know, the early part of this decade. And then, of course, unfortunately, he died of cancer, so we can't get him on the show. So,
well, and to add to your evidence about weather control, I mean, we're all, I mean, it's being talked about, well, in the alternate, you know, division of news or whatever. But you're right, it's coming out in the mainstream. And, you know, I mean, I think you and I talked about Operation Popeye, which was the Americans' plan to try to make the monsoon season last longer in Vietnam and, you know, make it really bad for the enemy. You know, we have derivatives on the stock market for weather.
What?
Well, yes. Joseph.
Wait. The stock market is basically a big betting pool where real money on a mega scale changes hands, like in futures and all that. You mean they're betting on the weather?
Yeah. So that means somebody knows something that's predictive. There's something going on there. And I don't think it's just a farmer's almanac, you know, esoteric, you know, thing. I think it's really some sort of understanding of there's a mechanism going on here. So, no, there's a lot of evidence to show that this is actually happening. I mean, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, the other piece that you said, just to back you up a little bit, is that you talked about the entry of our little Arjuna pebble. Because, I mean, so it coincides, are you saying, when Helene started?
Yes.
So are you suggesting?
No. I'm sorry. No. It when Helene reached North Carolina and killed Anna Marie, that's when Arjuna went into orbit.
Okay.
So that marked the beginning of its transit, its temporary presence around Earth, and the end of the most destructive storm in recent memory that did something that these storms never do, which is to make a left-hand turn and then sit there and kill people with rain after rain after rain, 18 inches in 24 hours.
Because, I mean, I know this is a big connecting of the dots and it's a huge speculation, but we did kind of say last week, you know, along the lines of Arjuna being, on the one hand, a Hindu history and all the implications of that, but also the idea that this could be a Trojan horse because of what I said is the association between Arjuna and Achilles. So are we kind of saying something like that, or are we just leaving that?
No. We're definitely saying something like that.
Yeah. So the Trojan horse may have entered, and we might have let it in.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Arjuna, it appears that this little guy, after it went into, you know, capture on the 29th that afternoon,
right,
as Helene is killing people in North Carolina, it's changed its orbit at least twice.
Oh.
And that is not a big deal in the mainstream press because, frankly, they don't understand science and celestial mechanics. So let me walk you through what we found out. The initial announcement by the Atlas Network, by the two Spanish scientists who found Arjuna on their survey plates back on August 7th, said that it was going to enter the orbit of the Earth temporarily and then leave on the 25th of November, and that the span between the 29th of September and the 25th of November is 56 days and change, okay? So that was the initial time it was going to spend hanging out somewhere around the Earth before the Earth's gravity released it back into solar orbit. That's important, as you'll hear later on in the morning. So the initial publication was 56 days. Then, about 10 days later, the ISRO people, the Indian Space Agency, they published a set of observations which were picked up by the Indian press, like the Times of India, et cetera, et cetera. And they list the orbital period as 53 days. But they still list the entry on the 29th of September and the exit on the 25th of November. Greg, among others, pointed out that that was probably just that somebody didn't know how to read right and that the orbit was the same, but it was unchanged. And frankly, we now have evidence that, in fact, the Israel people know how to do astronomy. I mean, this thing is so close. It's, you know, a million or 2 miles away. And so there's no possible way in a period of over a week that they could mistake where it is and its orbital period and its configuration by 3 whole days. That's a huge error. So I'm interpreting this as either a literary license to communicate 53 as opposed to 56, or the orbit really has changed and it will lever its influence on November 22nd, which of course is really wild because November is the 11th month. 22 is twice 11. There's an 11-11 mathematical equation I drew up decades ago connecting 19.5 with 33 by way of 11, 11, 11. And that 53 turns out to be critically important in David's continuing research into decoding the mathematics behind the Aruna apparition. Then I found, like 2 days ago, another scientific publication which apparently predated the Spanish publication of a 56-day temporary orbit, and they claimed it was 58 days. And again, this is not something at the distant edge of the solar system where a few microarc seconds make all the difference. This thing is literally right next door, and the telescopes are decent enough, and the computers are decent enough, that if there was a whole day error, 2 day error, between 58 and 56, so there's a progression, 58, 56, 53, is this thing, in fact, actively changing its orbit? And the mainstream is not saying anything. They're just publishing the numbers because either they're enjoined from drawing the obvious conclusion, this thing is changing its orbit like crazy, or they simply are putting out the numbers and praying and hoping that someone outside the inner circle will notice and make a fuss.
Yeah, Richard, you've mentioned, first of all, when you hear 56, you think of the 56 Aubrey holes at Stonehenge 1.
That was my first thought.
And second, if you go, and we talked about this on your show before, my item 3, which is the chart of the hyperdimensional planets and the visible planets, starting at the number 591, divided by the golden ratio, we get Earth, divided by the golden ratio, we get Venus, divided by the golden ratio again, we get orbit of 139.51, divided by the golden ratio again, we get Mercury.
David, everybody's eyes are glazing over. You need to be slow and careful with the numbers because Americans have been taught, be afraid of numbers, be very afraid. So start again.
Yeah, well,
please start again.
Okay. Because we're going to come to the number 53 in a second here. Okay, so again, when my wife Crystal died August the 9th, 2021, and noticed that asteroid PT5, which is what we're talking about, was discovered on August the 7th this year.
Right.
My wife called out my name at 591 days after she died. She knew that I would know what to do with the number. I divided it by the golden ratio, 1.618, and I got the exact sidereal orbit of Earth, which is 365.256, and the decimal just keeps going. I mean, that's freaking
right.
Phenomenal right there.
Now, wait, back up. Crystal, you heard her voice in the night, woke you up, right?
Yeah.
591st day after she died, right?
Right, which is 19.5 backwards.
Exactly!
Yeah.
19.5 backwards. Now, remember, I've been carrying on this bizarre, for new listeners, no, I've not lost my mind. I've been carrying on this bizarre conversation with Robin, who died 5 years ago this March, that involves geometry. It involves control of little life forms like insects and mice and pack rat has joined the menagerie. He's cute as a button. I've got to get video of this. But so I know from personal experience, which unfortunately is not democratizable in science. It's like why I don't mention it, because I can't put it on the table and say, look at this, because it's my personal experience. But what I have gleaned from my and David's totally independent communication with his crystal and me with Robin is there is life after death, big deal. It's possible to communicate, bigger deal, but the bandwidth is so limited that the communication is restricted to symbols, mythology, key numbers, key geometry, and in the extreme blinking of technological gadgets like lamps in Morse code.
And even the auroras of blinking in Morse code.
That's what blew me away tonight, because that's, I mean, it's who ordered this? This is nuts.
Yeah, so,
this is so nuts, but it's so correlating. In other words, we are living in truly extraordinary, extraordinary times. And I believe Robin has been trying to let me know that there's some huge ET event that is coming, because when she was doing the Morse up until something stopped her, she kept blinking ET, ET, over and over and over again, interspersed with I. Now, the I could either represent her, me, you know, I am that I am, or it could represent Isis, which is connected to Sirius and the mega constellation alignments that Greg was tracking a moment ago, or it could be something that's completely unconnected, because by the time she got to where she was sending really amazing, you know, at like half an hour of Morse code, and I'm trying to get a damn, you know, camera that will record it, suddenly everything stopped because something intervened and turned off the light, and it's now sitting there glimmering like an aurora, but it's not been flashing Morse code for like several weeks, 3 weeks now. It's been on but dormant, like something is suppressing it. And I have a feeling it has to do with this window. And again, leaping wildly in speculation, my feeling is that she was trying to tell me the importance of what's about to happen, and somebody cut her off, have censored it, because was it you, Andrew, who said if there's structure on this side of the veil, there has to be structure on that side, because you can't have organized consciousness without some kind of structure. There's got to be a framework. There's got to be a social contract. There's got to be an interoperability between beings either here or there or anywhere. Otherwise, you don't have anything coherent. It's just random background noise.
Yeah, that's what the...
So, David, if Crystal really was at the end of that calculation telling you 53 is crucial, and then this little guy, Arjuna, which I'm going to call it, is literally reiterating in the press releases from ISRO 53 days, that cannot be coincidence.
Yeah, because if you click on my item 3 and you keep going, you come to an orbit of 53.29, which is the orbit in the hierarchy of the nine levels of the angels, the cherubim. What do the cherubim carry? Bows and arrows. What does Arjuna carry? A bow and an arrow.
Oh, my.
See, cherubim are the bow and arrow. It's very symbolic. In our different cultures, artistically, and Andrew can appreciate this because he's an artist, we have a vision and we interpret it differently. In fact, the bow of Arjuna, which is called the Gandiva bow, was created by the Indian god Brahma in and which is Brahma and Abraham and Brahma are the same phonetical harmonic vibration. And when you see the bow of, this is in my item 2B, by the way, the bow is used by Indra for 3,585 years. Now, I was talking to Keith about this before the show, and he knew what that meant right away because that's 99.25% of accuracy to a 3,600-year orbit for Nibiru.
Oh, my God.
You see? So,
and I'm not kidding.
And so the Gandiva bow of Arjuna and this asteroid 2024 PT5 having an orbit of 53 days is the same orbit as my planet of the cherubim, which are also archers of bows.
And that's in the hidden mirror image solar system that you've been figuring out that is like the mirror reflection of the solar system we currently live in, which potentially would be the mirror image objects in another dimension, another hierarchy of our reality. Go ahead.
Tonight is Yom Kippur, and if you look on my charts, my item 3, quick on it, and you look at your hyperdimensional planets above the line and the visible planets we know below the line, planet 139-51 lines up with Yom Kippur, the miracle of the sun at Fatima. Tomorrow is the anniversary, by the way, October 13th. Today is Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement for the Israelites since God appeared on Mount Sinai and for Moses. And so there is an alignment to that actual date, because when you track on the lunar calendar versus the solar calendar will fail you every 156 years by one day, because our leap year doesn't absorb the imperfection in the exact sidereal time.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guests this morning are David Sarita, who you just heard, Andrew Curry, Greg Ahrens, and Georgia Lambert, our metaphysical resident, is waiting in the wings, and I'm going to bring her on next. You're on the other side of midnight. We're grappling with huge stuff, amazing stuff, correlating stuff. Don't touch that dial.
Drinking warm water before bed balances blood sugar levels and reverses type 2. Thousands of
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday night, October 12th. I'm anticipating the end of this incredible experience of connecting all these dots. Hurricanes, an interloper from interplanetary space, an ancient civilized epic focused on India, Hindu religion, the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, wait till you hear about the Bhagavad Gita. Anyway, back to our guests. Who had the floor? Was it David? Yes, David, you had the floor.
Okay. Yeah, I was just continuing. Now, let's just say you didn't use my chart and you took the orbit of our visitor, asteroid, 2024 PT5, at 53.29 days it'll be with us. Let's just do it precisely. Times the golden ratio repeatedly, 1.618. You will get Mercury next. You'll get the orbit of Mercury accurate to about 97%. Times the golden ratio again, you'll get my planet 139. Times the golden ratio again, you'll get Venus's orbit, 225 days. Times the golden ratio again, you will get Earth accurate to 99%. Times the golden ratio again, you'll get 591, which is inversely.
So this is all about a hyperdimensional code, not plain language. But the audience, us, are expected to figure this out. And this little object, this Arjuna satellite, mini moon,
cherubim
spacecraft,
Archer, it is its orbit will be synchronistic to an invisible hyperdimensional planet, and nobody can see it. All you got to do is take that number and multiply it by the golden ratio, and you'll go to all the planets in the solar system, and you'll go all the way to Nibiru, actually, if you just keep repeating the calculation times 1.618, and you'll hit them all. You'll hit Saturn, you'll hit Uranus and Neptune, and you'll eventually get to the same actual number that is just short of 3,600 years, that is the stated period that the god Indra held the bow of Gandharva, that Arjuna also held. So it
and which, courtesy of Keith, is the canonical number of Titian gives us for the orbit, the 3,600 year orbit of Nibiru, the planet.
And he said approximate.
I'm
rereading Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet. He said approximately 3,600 years. So why do we, in fact, I can take 591 times 1.618, and I think I have to do that 16 times, and I will get the same number. I'll get 92%. Or 99.2% of the orbit of Nibiru. I'll get the same number of the term that Indra used, the Gandharva bow.
Now, the reason that these aren't exactly 100% is because, drum roll, guys, the solar system planets have drifted. They are not always in the orbits that we see them in now. Over a long period of time, they were slightly different. And this message seems to be coming from a time when maybe the system was designed, when it was rearranged in my model by the cosmic engineers, borrowing from Clifford Simak mercilessly. In other words, all of this converging information is telling us the same thing. So pause. Georgia, you've been listening to all this. What are your thoughts?
A couple of different things. Of course, you guys have laid out all the science, and my job is to bring in the mythological and esoteric angle of things.
Or we would call it maybe the meta-science.
There you go. A couple of different points. Number one, September 29th. September 29th, when this little visitor knocked on the door here.
Right.
Is not by accident. September 29th, esoterically, is a very, very important day. It's, in Christian terms, it is St. Michael's Day, or the Feast of the Mass of Michael, Michaelmas. Our national cathedral in Washington was begun with a Masonic ceremony on St. Michael's Day, and 80 years later completed on St. Michael's Day with another Masonic ceremony. So what's the deal about September 29th? Esoterically, September 29th is the one day of the year that is most conducive to spirit into matter or will into form. In other words, this is the day, high or low, that intent can make the biggest splash in matter.
Oh my. Now, am I right in thinking that St. Michael in our tradition is really Arjuna in the Hindu tradition?
More than Arjuna. He's the great archangel. His earthly counterpart is St. George.
Okay.
George, I just want to ask you a question because you seem to know these Christian dates, because St. Francis's date of being visited by the seraph converted to the from Julian to Gregorian is September the 27th, which is interesting because you're saying the 29th. I just wanted to bring that up.
When you say when you say St. Francis, which St. Francis?
St. Francis of Assisi
okay.
received the stigmata on the 12th of September. It is celebrated in the Catholic Church on the Julian calendar, but that calendar corrected in the current date would be the 27th or 28th of September, which is so close to what Georgia is saying. So he
experience. It's even weirder because remember Helene, I'm going to paraphrase my grandmother here, Helene came to rest, stayed over western North Carolina, beginning from the 27th, 28th, and 29th. So that is not coincidental. That's part of the larger meta paradigm we're talking here.
If I could add a few more things, too.
Yeah,
absolutely. Go for it.
You mentioned November the 22nd. That, of course, is the anniversary of the JFK assassination.
Well, let's invert that. Why did someone murder JFK on November 22nd? That's my question.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you're going to answer, right?
Depends on what mythology somebody is following, doesn't it?
See, I'm thinking of the 11-11-11. You know, World War One was stopped literally at 11 a.m. on the 11th month and the 11th day of the year,
18? Yeah, something like that.
So that was not an accident. They concluded the treaty at 11 a.m. in a railroad car to make that huge symbolic hit of 11-11-11-11 because 11-11, translating 19.5, is a transition between here and there, hyperdimensionally, which really, in shorthand, means death.
Yeah. There's another point, but I don't know how far into the esoteric weeds you want to go.
Oh,
but
deeply. We've got plenty of time. Come on.
Okay. You asked for it.
We are thirsty. Go for it.
The development of the human being in terms of the spiritual path, there is a particular level of the path or initiation where three chakras within the head are activated. The one above the head called the crown, the one in front of the forehead called the Ajna Center, and there's a third one at the back of the skull. Now, the interesting thing about this is the symbols for this in mundane astrology is the Taurus symbol is related to the neck or the throat. But in esoteric astrology, Taurus is related to the center in front of the brow. Now think of the little symbol.
When you say Taurus, are we talking a donut shape?
No, we're talking about the constellation.
Oh, the constellation of Taurus. Okay, good.
Yes.
The bull.
Yes, exactly. Now, in esoteric astrology, Taurus is related to the center in front of the brow. Now think of the little symbol that symbolizes Taurus. It's the circle with the crescent on the top, like a little bull's face, right? The sign that makes Taurus. But when it's lifted to the forehead, those two are reversed. So you have the lunar crescent becoming the cup for the solar disk, which means sun over moon or spirit over matter. The center at the very back of the skull is called the sagittal center. It's related to Sagittarius, the archer with the bow.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of the symbol for Sagittarius, it's that arrow that's always on a particular angle. Well, there is a magnetic relationship between the center at the back of the skull, where the arrow points upward to the forehead at the bullseye of Taurus. And this means bringing the past up into the present moment to be dealt with.
Oh,
so when we apply this to the individual, this means bringing up all of the past incarnations into the present moment to be healed, to be balanced, to be righted. When we apply it to the planet, we're looking at our planetary past being brought up into the present moment to be consciously dealt with and
sorted
out.
So when you
out.
Say planet, you mean prior civilizations of human history.
Right, right.
Oh,
and
my.
According to esoteric tradition, you know, there's a lot of glamour and fantasy and garbage associated with the whole subject of Atlantis.
Is that a technical term?
Yes, exactly. But there's two themes that keep coming up in all the Atlantean traditions. Weather wars.
Oh, yeah.
Utilizing the natural elements as weapons, and genetic manipulation. And of course, we're doing both of those
absolutely
now. And the story...
One more thing
really quick.
Okay, all right.
The way to control the weather, whether it's wildfires or hurricanes, according to ancient tradition, is via sound. Projecting sound into the center of the storm
Is sound sound, or is sound an analog for frequencies?
Well, exactly.
Exactly. Okay, let me tell you my little insert. I looked up the energies of these guys, you know, last night. It took me a long time because for some reason somebody doesn't want us to know the energy of hurricanes. They're so gargantuan. They're so incomparable compared to anything in our experience, even nuclear weapons, that literally in 1 hour, Helene or Milton expended as much energy as the entire planet expends in a year. In all forms, electrical, thermal, burning stuff, campfires, oil, generate, you know, steam, everything. 1 hour is equivalent to a year's energy usage of Earth. So the idea in the mainstream, oh, it's crazy, it's ridiculous, it's absurd that humans could ever control hurricanes. No, you don't control it. You do a Eastern martial arts thing. You use the energy of the storm against itself, and that's why all the lightning and all the tornadoes, more than in any other event that Noah's ever tracked, broke out in the hours before landfall. Because you're reversing titanic energies back on themselves by manipulating, David, take a bow, frequencies.
Yeah, Richard, you made an important point about those lightning strikes. Remember, when you get what are called mega lightning strikes, you get antimatter. It forms a terrestrial gamma ray flash, which momentarily creates antimatter. So you would have had in that hurricane, with all those intense lightning strikes, antimatter being born and dying and born and dying and born and dying.
To say nothing of the sprites, the gamma ray emitting sprites above the hurricane thunderstorms up into the ionosphere, which had been photographed from ISIS, from the space station, stunning images. Just Google sprites, space station images of you know, thunderstorms. So we're talking about mega, mega energies, which are being turn back on themselves to turn these two recent storms, not saying anything about anything to come before in the previous decade, into weapons and then a counterforce, back and forth war to defeat whoever was sending them at us as lethal weapons.
And when you say whoever, go back to the Starliner audio, which I've decoded.
Well, let's not get there yet. No, we're
okay,
not,
but that, remember, that predates the hurricane.
Yes.
That's August 31st.
Yeah, okay. So someone else
that could be...
Richard?
It's probably...
This is Greg.
Yes, Greg, go for it.
Oh, somebody was talking, you know, we're talking about sound frequencies
Georgia.
Yes. There was a friend of mine on Facebook said, in Hungary, when there's a storm coming, they ring all the church bells. And this was before Milton was making its way to Florida, and said, you know, they should put all the pastors should all get together and start ringing their church bells and, you know, keep Milton from being so big. And in my first
thought... That's interesting, Greg, because
in my
those
first,
waves might interact with it. That's really interesting.
It might be. My thought was, well, they don't have hurricanes in Hungary. And then I thought, well, it works.
That reminds you of that old elephant joke. You know, let me think how it goes. Why do elephants paint their toenails red?
Oh, yeah. Shoot, I forgot.
To hide in cherry trees.
Right, yeah.
And the next
I've never seen an elephant in a cherry tree.
See, it works. Okay, David, you were saying. I'm sorry, Georgia, sorry.
No, I was just saying that all of the patterns in play are more than what they seem on the surface, because this is all part of our planet's taking its next step, of humanity taking its consciousness. And part of that has to do with bringing up a lot of old stuff to be balanced and transmuted in the present moment. You know, in past shows, we've talked about how we seem to be in a time where we're having echoes of previous cycles. You know, we have patterns coming up to be dealt with from World War II and what went on there. We've got patterns coming up from the Civil War. We've got old Atlantean stuff going way back, and it's all converging in the present moment to be dealt with.
And ancient Hindu Vedic history, of which Aruna, who is a warrior god or demigod, you know, good against evil, is a simile for, Andrew, you're up next, Achilles, and there's other incredibly interesting Greek parallels.
Can I throw in one more thing quickly?
Yeah, of course.
When Richard and I were talking this week, he mentioned that Arjuna was, of course, schooled Krishna, and Krishna is always blue in all of the Hindu paintings and traditions. Krishna is usually shown as blue. Well, again, going back to esoteric history, that there were earlier expressions of humanity that were blue-skinned, and everybody goes, oh, well, that's just fanciful. Well, I mentioned to Richard something that I had learned back in the early 70s about blue people living in Kentucky and Appalachia, that there is, you can Google it, it's all over the internet.
What you need to do is to send the link you sent to me to Keith, and we'll post it as your item. Because Andrew, when you saw the picture, you absolutely were. You said what?
Yeah, I mean these people, bright red hair, many of them, but were very blue skinned, and they interbred in families, and it was considered normal, and everybody just knew that this particular family line was the blue people, and they were perfectly normal except that they were blue. And so we've got, again, you know, perhaps the very ancient trait of humanity of raising its head at this particular time, and just about the place where Helen did some real damage.
Exactly. Oh my God, that's so freaky, because it was decades later. You told me, I think, that some doctor figured out that this family was missing an enzyme, and when he was able to insert it into the children, they turned pink. They turned normal human looking.
Yeah, exactly.
And the, and there's this group photo showing the elders blue. I mean, blue is as the sky.
And it ranges. In some are just kind of slightly
right.
cool looking, but others are actually indigo. There's a photograph of an older gentleman that is actually indigo. And these, you know, were just, you know, part of the community, and just they were just known as the Blue Fugits. That was the family name.
So send the link to Keith. He'll post it. Either send it in the Skype window or send it as email, and he'll post it for the archive for Club 19.5. Okay, so now I want to go back to Andrew, because Andrew, you and I had the conversation that how would you get blue human beings? Remember that?
Yeah.
And I said the same as black humans are adapted melanin-wise to resist the rays of the sun, the UV.
Yeah.
If you live on a planet orbiting a much brighter, hotter, bluer star like Sirius or the O and B type stars that Stephen last week called in about in the Pleiades, that, you know, the humans did not originate under those stars, but they migrated there a la colonization, starships, that kind of thing, and then they grew up there. The adaptation of skin color would be in the direction of ameliorating the most damaging electromagnetic radiation on that planet. And if you think of, you know, blue would reflect, if you just put it in the, take a look. If you think of the blue as reflecting, you know, short wavelength violet and ultraviolet light, it's an adaptation, an environmental adaptation. And the only way you get rid of it is to breed with other humans who are under a different color sun and don't need that adaptation. And you can literally see it in this generational photograph that Georgia just put in the Skype chat window. And don't everybody speak at once.
I want to tell you about a blue experience I had. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I was raised in California. My dad was getting a PhD in the 60s in UC Berkeley and divorced my mom. And then I was raised by a Texan father, David Cooper. So I was a Cooper for 6 or 7 years. And then I come back to my real father because my mom divorced him. My dad takes me to a yoga retreat in Canada. I didn't know anything about Krishna and blue people. And I meet this guru named Baba Haridas, and I'm just a kid. I'm like a teenager. And I'm doing yoga, and I go to sleep that night, and I start to, this paralysis starts moving up my spine, like I'm being paralyzed from, you know, from one chakra to the next, to the next, to the next. I didn't even know what a chakra was. And all of a sudden, it gets in my neck, and I feel like I'm going to die, like it's choking me. And I relax, and I pass out. And suddenly there's three blue people in front of me shining with light. And there's a monkey man, and I didn't never heard of this monkey
man. Oh, my God,
that was
Hanuman.
That's Hanuman. I didn't know who they were. That's how pure my experience was. And Rama, who is blue, has jewels in his forehead, and he's shining with this blinding blue light. And there's a woman next to him who would have been Sita. So Sita, Rama, and Hanuman appeared to me, and they're all blue. Even the monkey was blue.
And how old were you?
I was about 13.
Okay.
So I wake up, and I tell the guru the next morning in front of all the students. There must have been a few hundred. And he laughed, and he told his disciple to go show David this picture on the wall of Rama, Sita, and Hanuman. And, of course, Rama is an incarnation of Krishna. I learned this all later, but I had never seen a picture of the Bhagavad Gita, which I've now read the whole thing. But what's interesting to me is they were blue. The light coming off of them was too powerful for me. I was kind of, you know, humbled to the ground in front of them, kind of prostrated. And I didn't know what to make of the experience because I had no prior
Well, you had no context.
I had no context, so how could my mind have created this if it was my imagination?
Mm.
Yeah.
I think somebody was in communication. What do you think, Georgia?
Either that or the age at which he experienced this was part of his recapitulation, bringing past wisdom from other incarnations into this one. Maybe he was retrieving stuff he knew some other time.
Hmm.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, my dad got us all into yoga and gurus. I mean, I've met a lot of gurus over the years, and I've been meditating every day
I'm hearing a weird whirring sound. What's that coming from?
A whirring? Oh, is it? You mean in my voice? Or
No, background. Noise. It's like something is spinning and then clicking.
Huh. Oh, no, that's not me. That's somebody else.
I think somebody's blowing on one of those party things, Richard, that spin around on a stick.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Okay.
But it's gone
now. Interesting because told me about the blue people.
Who did?
Dan Aykroyd told me about the blue people.
Okay.
And he knows about the blue people. So it is interesting. I mean, blue light, of course, is hotter than orange light. Our sun is a really old sun. The Pleiades star system, of course, is the leg of the bull, so that's Taurus. And those stars are much hotter because they're much younger. I mean, we're hanging around a really old star. I mean, this sun.
Well, but see,
ancient.
What I was saying to Stephen, the last weekend, is that the reason that these stars are desirable is because there's where the HD physics will be highest. You know, G-type stars, our sun, our solar system, is really at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to hyperdimensional connection. O and B-type stars, which are the biggest and the brightest, and they only live for less than a million years, or Sirius, which is much cooler but lives probably two or three times longer than our sun will, it's hyperdimensionally, that's where you want to be if your consciousness striving to have more connection. And I have no idea what that weird sound is. But fortunately,
break time.
We are at the top of the hour, so we will leave the sound behind. Thank you, Keith.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment to your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight for this now Sunday morning, Saturday evening, on The Other Side of Midnight here in the Land of Enchantment. Are we tying the dots together to your satisfaction? There are relationships, there are mythological ancient histories, there are numbers, there is physics, There is coincidence that's not coincidence. It is convergence. And you haven't even heard the best part yet, which is what we're going to get to in the next hour. Now, if you want to join, well, you actually can't because Blog Talk is down. So I guess it's up to us chillins to kind of fill out the next hour. I want to go now back to Andrew. I want you to connect dots between Arjuna, the warrior, and Achilles, and then we go from there to other parts of the Odyssey.
Yeah, for sure. So if we go to my number two in Radio with Pitchers, and like that's funny, Keith put down my title is Sunita Sunny Williams in brackets, Sunny, and he bracketed Sun, which actually comes in play here in a bit. But if you tap on my number two and just enlarge it, Richard and I have had these discussions about, Richard, you want to give a quick review on the two astronauts, please?
Well, these two astronauts, Sunita Williams, who is of Indian heritage, she's Hindu. She lives near one of our listeners, Stephen, there in, I think it's Needham, Massachusetts, not far from where I lived in Springfield, just outside of Boston. And her pilot, Butch Wilmer, were the two astronauts selected by NASA to fly the Boeing Starliner, separate commercial crew spacecraft developed by NASA to be a transportation shuttle like the Dragon, like Musk's Dragon spacecraft to and from low Earth orbit, i.e. the space station. And NASA, of course, you know, no single point failure. They gave contracts to more than one aerospace company. SpaceX was the one for the Dragon, Musk company. And the other contract, which was like 10, 15 years old now, was given to the Boeing Aerospace Corporation, which, you know, built the Apollo command module. And I'm sorry, not the command module, but some of the parts of the Saturn V rocket. They you know, have been a huge component of the U.S. space program and the NASA program from the very beginning. So NASA, you know, had these two contracts, one to Musk, SpaceX, the other to Boeing. And the Boeing Starliner, which they came out with a name some years later, has been plagued by all kinds of bizarre problems. It's like they've had two test flights, and then they had a human flight, which was the one that Sonny and Butch were on. But it's been problem-plagued. And then, of course, when they finally got to the space station on this third effort to kind of rate the spacecraft to what's called man rating before it's put into regular commercial service as, you know, shuttling astronauts back and forth to the station, they had thruster problems, they had computer problems, they had helium leak problems, and they ultimately wound up saying, well, wait a minute, this thing may not make it home so that the astronauts will survive. So the eight-day mission kind of reminds me of Gilligan's Island. They were only supposed to be on an eight-day voyage, has now turned into months and months and months. They went into orbit and rendezvous back on June 5th of this year. They're now going to be stranded, not technically, but politically and in terms of program decisions, till next February of 2025. And they're up there from June of this year till February of next year. And I've raised all kinds of weird questions, which I'm going to, you know, amplify later in this hour, our final hour. But finally, when they did decide to keep them there, for some weird reason, they made Sunita Williams, Sunny, the commander of the space station. And you have no idea how absolutely outrageous and bizarre that is, because the astronauts spend years training for particular missions. And they trained a previous station commander who was in charge. I don't remember his name, but he was part of the last crew that came up on the Dragon spacecraft several months ago, more than maybe 6 months ago. And he's, you know, doing his job. He's commanding the experiments and the air to ground and the rendezvous and docks with the progress vehicles. In other words, he's the station commander. And suddenly a visitor who is only supposed to be there 8 days and is stranded now for, you know, 7-8 months, it replaces him in the pecking order as the commander of the space station. And frankly, this is frigging nuts. Can you imagine how he feels? Because all his training, all his, you know, background, all his preparation to become the station commander, suddenly, and of course, in these institutions, be it NASA or military, you know, promotions, pecking order, getting, you know, getting ahead, achieving the next rank, and all that's super important. That's why you stay in these services for, you know, decades and go from being an ensign to an admiral or a general or whatever, or in this case, station commander of the only space station that the U.S. has up there, going to have up there at least until 2030 and maybe beyond. So suddenly she is ordered to supersede him and assume command of the station, which if you're looking at this from any regular mainstream NASA history or background, is just totally frigging nuts. But not if you're looking at it as I have been looking at it for many, many months now, which is the hidden coded reason that our two astronauts are, quote, stranded, is because Sunita Williams had to be aboard the space station covering now this period of time for Arjuna to be temporarily captured, entering Earth orbit on the 29th of September, leaving our influence either on the 25th or maybe the 22nd of November, straddling this period where Sunita is there, Arjuna coming out of the Hindu mythology of Krishna and the interaction of the gods with the ancient peoples of Earth, written down in a Hindu sacred text called the Bhagavad Gita, which translates as God's song. And Andrew found the other day, you're going to love this, that among the items that NASA has published that the two astronauts took on their day Gilligan's Island planned trip to and from the station, Sunita took a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, of all the ancient sacred texts. She took the one book that mentions Arjuna and Krishna and God knows only what else. Andrew, take it from there.
Thanks, Richard. Well, again, if you go to my number two, I've done a few screen captures. Just, I dug a little bit. Richard kind of set me on the course here, and I dug a little bit into this lady. She just turned 59, by the way, which became a huge moment of celebration across India. There were all kinds of Indian singers and DJs, you know, posting on social media.
Well, you can imagine. She's a celebrity. She's a superstar in India.
Well, what's really interesting, Richard, is that, I mean, she's American.
Yep.
Her father was Indian, and her mother was Slovenian, so she's a happy. But as she ages, this is very interesting, as she ages, and she's aging, you know, beautifully, gracefully, but she's beginning to look more and more Indian. And what I mean by that is in her early days, you know, she just, you know, she had different hairdos and she was probably very much entrenched in American life and growing up and going to school and doing all the amazing things that she's done, but, which, by the way, she's a very accomplished person. She can fly. Well, she teaches, but she can obviously fly over 30 different kinds. And she was a helicopter operator, apparently doing some sort of assist in the Gulf War. This person is – she's someone to be reckoned with.
Yeah,
okay?
She joined the Navy. She's done all this stuff as part of the U.S. Navy.
Yeah. And so when the Starliner, when the Boeing, as Richard sort of set up for me – when they docked finally with the ISS, I guess they ring a bell, Richard, as they end. Yeah. And as she was coming through, they were playing some music, and she did this funky dance coming into the
in like, zero gravity.
Yeah. So her hair is like everywhere, And she's got this wild look on her face, and she's sticking out her tongue like you often see with a lot of these Hindu gods. And she's sort of doing this wiggly dance, and then she gets up and she starts doing a bit more dancing. And everybody's having a great time because, as Richard said to me, she's a very exuberant personality. And then, Richard, what did you tell me, that there are examples of her doing this?
Well, when she was previously commander of the space station, which was years ago, she actually made a big deal of her Indian dance routine. And there are videos, YouTube videos of her before this mission, dancing her little heart out in zero gravity. And, of course, all her devotees in India are absolutely going ape, you know what, because it's so cultural. It's so Hindu. It's Arjuna, because Arjuna was a demigod of dance and song. And, of course, the song is all about, and we're going to get back to David, frequencies.
Yeah.
So continue.
And what's really interesting is that, I mean, she's, as I said, she's a mixed blood gal. And, you know, she's half Slovenian. Her mother was a very beautiful white lady. But they really emphasize sort of her Indian parts, which she does as well. Like, she's really embraced it. And she has countless interviews about this, about how the Indian culture, and she's become a Hindu. I mean, she is, I don't remember how long it's been, but she is definitely a Hindu practitioner. So on that, if you go to my number two, this is back in 2007 when she was in India doing the rounds.
This is number two on number two.
On number two.
The big poster is the number two poster. And then the number two item on that poster is what you're looking at now.
Yeah, and so she's dancing what's called the Garba folk dance. And Garba is basically a fertility dance. And it's, you know, it's a folk dance. It's something
Hold it. Okay. Georgia? Georgia?
Yes?
Did you hear that?
I know.
Fertility dance? What do we say? Maybe her reason for being stuck on the space station is she's having a baby in zero gravity, and this is a very deep experiment?
Well, we postulated about that last week, didn't we?
Yeah. Okay, Andrew, continue.
Yeah. So one of the things that she talks about, and by the way, there's lots of great videos. Everybody should, in listener land there, just go and listen to her. She's a very, she's very energetic, effervescent, highly
incredible.
Intelligent.
She is centered and incredible.
Yeah.
She's the perfect person in my model to be an ambassador upstairs between us and them, whoever them are, and them may have arrived in Arjuna.
Well, she did this little tour around the space station. And I've never seen someone be so elegant in explaining a bathroom. Brushing her teeth and going to the washroom. Like, she was so beautifully elegant. It was like, oh, that sounds like it could be kind of fun. You know, so, yeah, she's quite the diplomat. But one of the things that she's been emphasizing, and you can find bits and pieces of this, meaning that it's not always, there's an Indian-Hindu emphasis, is that she brought three texts, ancient texts, into space with her. One was the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and Homer's The Odyssey.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, which, you know, the Upanishads apparently, you guys probably, George, you might know more about this than me, but I was just briefly looking at it, and it looks like it's sort of, I guess as Hinduism became more formed, this text sort of codifies it a bit better. But it's an ancient book, right? And of course, as we talked about the Bhagavad Gita, which is part of the bigger tome, the Mahabharata, the bigger epic poem.
Oh, you're doing really well with that. Gosh.
Well, I have a rune, by the way, here tomorrow night, which he's accepted.
That's Andrew's Indian friend who's been very absent, and we want to connect with him because I want ISRO to take close-up pictures of Arjuna with the only spacecraft in orbit that's at the fuel and is ready and cocked and waiting to go and do that. And I bet this is on their agenda even without me suggesting it. I bet.
Yeah, well, it's our Canadian Thanksgiving, folks, tomorrow night. So happy Thanksgiving to all you Canadian listeners out there. And so he's going to be here, so I'm going to just press on him after a few glasses of wine.
Good.
So with the Odyssey, of course, this is the 10-year journey after the Trojan War that Odysseus took. He was the Ithacan king, trying to get back to his wife and his kid. So
her name
was
Penelope, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, it was Penelope.
Yeah, and it's another beautiful epic, and you know she talks about this. She says, "I thought these were important." I mean, she's obviously bringing pieces of her, both sides of her culture up, but they're very significant books, as we have just outlined for you.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know,
well,
we're back to Casablanca. Of all the gin joints and all the Bhagavad Gitas in the world, that's the one sacred book, well, one of two, that she takes into the station to be with her when suddenly this little Arjuna guy shows up.
Yep.
So if come
you scroll
on.
Down,
remember
if
FDR.
You scroll...
In politics, yeah, yeah. There's no such thing as coincidence. And the NASA story about why they're there and why they're stuck and all that. I have a piece of data I forgot, Keith, to post. We'll post it as an A after the show for the archive. But there's literally a new NASA study came out this week. They remember the space station experiments have been involved a lot of heavy medical stuff. You know, they're testing drugs in zero gravity so they can make commercial versions to help people down here. And there's this huge industry of materials and medications. And they've actually synthesized, you know, by I think it's cloning, heart muscles. And they've got them wired to a computer in the station. And the experiment they reported on this week, which is a hell of a news story, is that Earth gravity keeps hearts beating in time and with perfection. And when you take the same muscles into orbit and wire them up, they suddenly go crazy and begin to fibrillate and decohere and all that. So being in orbit is deadly for astronauts in zero gravity beyond a certain period of time. And both these astronauts, Sunita Williams and Butch Wilmer, have been in space in the station and in the shuttle years before for extended periods of time. So their being in orbit, their being stuck, their being, quote, stranded, is really bad for them unless there's a bigger mission and they have to fulfill the mission, which is why the cover story that they're stranded. Again, the dots are not only converging, they're forming very straight lines with arrowheads at the end of them.
Do you know that one of the Hindu gods, Shiva, who is also called the Destroyer, dances the sacred dance on the sinoatrial node of the heart?
Oh, my.
Shiva also wears a belt of skulls.
Yeah, well, destruction, destroyer.
Yeah.
Well, the life thread anchors in the heart at the sinoatrial node, the pulse point in the heart. It's esoterically, you're connected to your body via two threads, the consciousness thread anchored in the head near the pineal gland and the life thread anchored in the heart at the SA node.
Now,
So the Hindu god dances the eternal beating rhythm of the heart of the planet or of the human being. At that particular place, at the heart. And also, the heart is very group conscious. They've done studies where they've taken viable heart tissue in two different petri dishes, and when they get close enough but not physically touching, their beats synchronize.
Oh, my.
Now, here's my model. I think there's a deep part of NASA that knows all the stuff that we know and a lot more. How to control hurricanes, how to ameliorate these heart problems in the station in zero gravity. The mainstream guys think it's about the, you know, zero gravity versus Earth's gravity. I think it's totally fallacious, either a cover story or they're really too dumb. But the guys who know, the folks behind the scenes who know that it's an asymmetry in the physics, because remember, the Earth rotates on its axis, and we know from from circadian rhythm studies that we're linked to the rotation of the planet through the HD torsion field connection. Well, all you have to do to keep the heart going fine is to simulate with the right technology that HD torsion field resonance in the space station. And I will bet dollars to Navy beans, listen, Sonny, Navy, that they have an amelioration in the form of a technology so that Butch and Sonny will experience no heart problems because they're protected for the fact that their mission demands they're there now and they stay through next February.
And the particular rhythms of music have a profound effect on the heart. For instance, there's been studies done where bodybuilders working out to waltz time music, three-quarter time, their muscles perform far better.
What?
Then, yeah, because it mimics the beat of the heart, the three-quarter time.
Oh, my gosh. It,
if you look at ancient war music, for instance, American marches, John Philip Sousa, are all in 4-4 time. But the ancient Scottish war marches are all in 3/4 or 6/8 time.
And they're done by bagpipes.
Among other things, yes. And so they knew that these particular rhythms, there's a whole science called behavioral kinesiology that has to do with what certain rhythms in music and poetry have on the body.
That could be the antidote. They're just wearing headphones for a certain period of time like the other exercises, and they're synchronizing their heart rhythms with the Earth below them. Because remember, they're a separate planet orbiting with a separate HD beat frequency. Yes, David?
The Starliner frequencies I mapped.
Hang on. We're not there yet.
I know you're not there yet, but I'm just going to tell you something really quick.
Well, wait until we get there, because we're almost there.
No, wait a second. The beat of the Starliner is the same beat you're talking about right now. The tung, tung, tung.
Okay.
It's like a metronome.
Hang on.
And the frequencies are in addition to that.
I want to go back to Andrew, because there's more interstitial glue between these cultures, this mission, controlling hurricanes, secret knowledge of the physics, all of it.
Yeah, and I really want to – I know we got about 5 minutes before the end of the half hour, so I want to jump. The other things that she brought on board with her was a little idol of Lord Ganesha, which is another Hindu symbol. It's a look like an elephant god, and it's all about protection and the removal of obstacles, you know, from one's way. And then she also brought – the Om symbol. And the Om symbol is a Hindu symbol representing sacred sound, like we just talked about, syllables or mantras. And then she also brought samosas, which really made the Indians happy as well, and a Slovenian flag and some Slovenian food. Now, there are three stars in the Slovenian – I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, Richard, but there's three stars in an upside-down pyramid on a Slovenian
or
flag.
Or an equilateral triangle.
I know, and I'm going, I know she's Slovenian. I know that's convenient, but So anyways, those were the things that she brought on board. And I want to come out of that really quick. I know we have a few minutes here. I want to go to my number three poster. We can come back if we want to talk about that. But if you click on my number three, now there's a really kind of what I'm calling now a kind of a famous picture of Sunita touching the sun. If you look at my first picture.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is, Richard, so much – well, why don't you set this up when this happened? This was back in 2012.
Frankly, I don't remember.
Okay, so it's apparently when she was on the International Space Station. Oh, by the way, she owns the record now for the most spacewalks for a woman, which is 7.
Of course.
And she's the second Indian astronaut, female, to go up besides the gal that was in – well, the shuttle that crashed, I forget the woman's name. We'll have to get that before the show is over. But I saw something highlighted today about that.
You mean
but
the Columbia back in 2003?
Yes, exactly. There was an Indian gal there too.
Yep.
So in this shot, this reminds me literally of Alan Bean's painting Reaching for the Stars. And this has so much symbology in terms of Richard Stargates and the sun being an avenue. You've got all this, and I know we're about 90 seconds out almost, so I'm going to scroll down to the what was called the exhibition.
No, actually, we have more time. You know, keep going. I'll let you know.
Well, this was the crew that she was on, that you could see all the folks that were there.
Expedition 32.
And then she became the commander for Expedition 33.
Of course, it had to be. Huh.
So, now there's one more poster I'd love to take you through everybody through, because, Richard, it has a Star Trek connection.
Yeah.
And it's all got to do with popular art, pop culture, I mean. But I'm wondering if we should do that when I come back.
Yeah, let's do that on the other side, and then we have the big reveal. Oh, my God, do we have a reveal tonight? Hang on, my computer is hanging up. Come on, do this. Okay. It's being very laggy. Okay, why is it being laggy? Probably a lot of folks are looking at the site. That's probably why it's lagging. Okay, let me do this. Sorry about this, folks. This is real-time radio. You know, you always have these interesting little adventures. So, all right, tell you what, let's do this. Let's go to a break. My guest tonight, too numerous to mention, but we will do that when we come back. And these damn commercials, why are they intruding tonight? They never have intruded before. It's really kind of weird. Anyway, we're on Sunday morning, Saturday night. We've got four huge guests, Georgia, David, Greg, and Andrew. And we've got one hell of an ending for the last half hour. You're on the other side of midnight. More dots on the other side. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday morning, Saturday evening. I believe, Andrew, we were going to go to another poster, right?
Yes. So if we go to my number four, again, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, go to the show page and go under my items and you hit number four. I have to do this, Richard, every time. If I find a pop culture reference, I have to find it.
Of course.
And we're talking about numbers and predictions and the strangeness of art mimicking life and life mimicking art. Well, there was a very great series when I was a little kid, at least, called The $6 Million Man, and it ran between 1974, I think, to 1978, and it was basically about, well, it was Lee Majors, very famous American actor, who basically had an, he was an astronaut, had an accident doing a test flight and had to have two legs, his right arm, and one of his eyes, I believe it might have been his left eye, replaced by bionics. He basically became a cyborg. And Richard, it was an incredible show. And one of the episodes in season one, Tap on My Number 4, is an episode called The Rescue of Athena 1. And let me just really quickly read the synopsis, and then I'm going to give you the Star Trek connection. Steve Austin.
And, of course, Athena is another Greek
figure. Exactly. Steve Austin, Lee Majors, is posted to NASA, where he is tasked with training America's first female astronaut, Major Kelly Woods, who happens to be Farrah Fawcett, who at the time was married to him, and she was very beautiful. And every boy had her poster on their wall or in their locker at one point or another. Anyways, despite initial problems, Major Woods completes her training and is launched into Earth orbit in Athena 1 with fellow astronaut Major Osterman on a mission to discover new sources of energy. Shortly afterwards, Athena 1 is rocked by an explosion which seriously injures Osterman. Fortunately, Major Woods is able to dock the crippled space capsule to the orbiting Skylab space station, where it is intended she will await the arrival of a rescue team and a doctor. However, the explosion has jammed the capsule's hatch, trapping Woods and Osterman inside. Steve Austin, the $6 million man, is launched into space alongside flight surgeon Wolf to treat and rescue the trapped astronauts. Upon docking with Skylab, Steve manages to force the trapped hatch open, giving Woods and the still unconscious Osterman access to the space station. Flight surgeon Wolf subsequently carries out a surgical procedure to remove shrapnel from Osterman. However, during a spacewalk to carry out repairs to Athena 1, listen to this, Richard, Steve's bionics begin to malfunction due to the higher levels of radiation present. Mm-hmm. As a result, Major Woods has to command the Athena 1 rescue capsule containing all four astronauts inside successfully back to Earth. And guess who wrote this episode? D.C. Fontana.
Oh, my God, who was Gene Roddenberry's right-hand gal and a producer on the original Star Trek series.
And she would do these little Easter eggs in the $6 Million Man series, because I think she penned at least two or three of them.
Yeah.
But anyways, here, little trivia. Fontana seems to have snuck in an Easter egg reference to Star Trek at the end, where Steve says to Oscar, at the end of this episode, "Space, it is the final frontier."
Oh, my.
But, Richard, the connections to what's going on now, I know it's a different slant. I mean, the female character rescues. I mean, D.C.
Was that a deliberate Emily Dickinson reference, a different slant?
Well, I mean, D.C. Fontana was a woman, and she was creating strong, at the time, what would be considered very strong female characters, right?
Right.
And now we see, I'm just looking at the parallels to this episode with, I mean, obviously we're not talking about the entry of an alien or a spacecraft, but then new energy sources, who knows what that might have meant back in that series. So I just wanted to share that with everyone. I thought it was a really cool, kind of weird, forward-looking, who knows.
Okay.
So there you go.
Now I got to go to David. David, it's time for frequencies. Go for it.
Yeah, you haven't even got to Trump's gold watch yet.
Well, that's the end of the show. God, why do you keep giving away the show?
Okay, so let's go to the Starliner, because the Starliner is August 31st. And if you go to my item 7, you can see the actual recording, because I subbed it out, so you don't have to listen to the astronauts chatting. Starliner sounds if you want to hear it. Now, I brought it
in. Can I click on this and we hear it?
Yeah.
Okay, let me see if I can. Which one do I click on, the top or the bottom?
It says Starliner sounds, the word Starliner sounds in orange.
Oh, so I click on that. Okay, so here's what they sound like. Okay. Okay, now let me tell you the background. This radio signal suddenly popped up on the Starliner radio system of the capsule, the Boeing spacecraft, but on none of the other radios of the space station, of which they've got dozens. And so Butch recorded it with a handheld mic in front of the speaker in the cabin of the Starliner, and then sent it down to Houston and said, guys, what the hell is this? Can you figure it out? And about 2 hours later, they said, oh, it's merely an audio loop. It's a feedback loop. Throw switch, you know, 95-C7, and it'll go away. And that, of course, is what they supposedly did. And, of course, I thought immediately, it's a cover story because it's a signal from someone out there, part of the preparation for the Ambassador Sonny Williams role that I've been projecting in this model. This is all really a cover story for. So what did you find out?
So I brought it into a software that doesn't use any microphones. It analyzes the waves and tells you the frequencies. And so when you look at the graphic in my item 7, the green is the waveform. Notice that those beats are very similar to a human heartbeat. And like a metronome where you're setting the beat to music. But second, below where you see the bright, like, you know, purple and red and yellow colors, I've marked the actual frequencies. And it's stunning. Well, you're literally dragging a cursor precisely on the center of the hammering beat, the dun, dun,
which is showing up in the green below the
It's showing all the numbers you see. So the lowest number, they're all 432. Exactly. Every single hammer beat.
Holy cow!
Is exactly 432 hertz.
Michael's disc frequencies that have incredible healing capabilities that we've talked about endlessly. This is, you can't make this stuff up.
You can't make this up. Now, when you go, if you go in close, there are a total, actually, of four lines that go horizontal. The second line, which is weaker in amplitude than the first line is the bottom line. So that's where you see the brightest hot spots on the peaks,
right,
which are matching the green above. So the second line is all 591, which is Crystal's number, which
not, decodes and is, the, not, is 19.5 backwards.
Is 19.5 backwards.
Oh, my God.
And believe me, I'm putting my cursor so precisely on that line. And if I move it a millimeter, the number changes just a little bit. So remember, you're not. There's no such thing as 100%. But believe
well,
we
used to say within the measurement errors. This is right
within
on.
The measurement errors. Your third line is all 1296s, and that's 432 times 3 is 1296.
Oh my God! The three missing days.
So, but there's one more number, there's one more line in there I didn't do. It's a 15-something. It's harder to get my cursor on it. I will eventually get the fourth line. These are horizontal lines. You can see them. If you click on my second photograph, it's a close-up on my item 7. There's two photographs there.
I'm lost. Are we still in 7?
Yeah, you're still in 7.
So there's a top and then a middle and a bottom. Which one are we clicking on?
Well, there's the top, and then just click on the lower photograph. I know it looks like three photographs, but it's just two because of the black background.
Okay, so it's the very bottom greenish thingies.
Yeah, just click on that, and you'll see that's what it looks like.
Oh, wow.
And in the audio frequency analysis, you look for your horizontal lines, and then you see these bright spots, that's where my cursor's going to get these numbers.
Okay.
It's really precise. There's no sloppiness here at all. So there's no way, when you know what these numbers mean, you know what the 19.5 and the 591 means, which is in the middle, and we all know what 432 means. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
And it shows up at the Giza Plateau. It shows up in Angkor Wat. It shows up in other Indian temples. It's a biological frequency. And David, did you miss the part where During the eclipse, it shows up as a Chladni pattern in the umbra of the total solar eclipse.
Yeah, I saw that data. I remember
this,
that.
This,
when
this,
you...
I told you tonight was going to be history-making. This is history-making. You have done...
Now, remember, these frequencies were probably... Now, I can match each of these frequencies, and there's more numbers in there. I need to pull them out. I know how to do it. They all match octaves of the planets in the solar system in their respective frequencies based on their wavelength.
In the designer solar system, half of which has been given us by your departed crystal, we talked about earlier in the show, talk about synthesis, talk about convergence, talk about... Our time has come, boys and girls.
Yeah, and this would have been transmitted all over the Earth. There's no way this was an accident. This was not feedback. They were probably confused why it was coming in. But if they did a frequency analysis like I have in a professional software, they would see these numbers, but there's more numbers in there. I need to zoom in on my horizontal
okay,
line.
Okay, we're running out of time.
Yeah, okay.
The next thing we're going to preview, because we're going to obviously continue in another show, probably next weekend, because there's so much more that's going to happen. Something amazing is going on upstairs. We've got a visitor. We've got correlations. We've got ancient history. We have multiple cultures. We've got an Indian ambassador waiting. Then we enter the world of Donald J. Trump. Now, Trump has put out, starting with the NFT, you know, trading cards, an absolutely amazing series of things he's offering to the general public for sale, starting with the cards. Then the next thing were golden sneakers. Then we had his Bible, you know, the Trump Bible, which is, you know, got the Constitution in it, made in China. We're not supposed to know that, I guess. And then finally, he started offering a couple weeks ago this $100,000 gold watch. And when you look at this, totally apart from all the garbage out there about Trump and all the political garbage around the campaign and all that, we're basically now down to symbols, credible symbols, of which the last, the watch, said to me, we're looking at some kind of link to time. Something is going to happen in time. This is a Emily Dickinson reference to something is happening in terms of time. So I started looking with Andrew last night and then David this afternoon at the watches, and it's absolutely mind-boggling. David, take it over again, because no one's going to believe me if I say it.
Okay, so first of all, you and I, Richard, did this on my item one. From December 31st, the end of the year, to the day Trump was shot on July 13th, 2024, is 195 days, which is 19.5. Now, when you go to the gold watch, click on Richard's item 14. And that second hand is exactly 19.5 seconds. I mean, Richard, we zoomed in Photoshop. It's 19.5 seconds.
Yep.
To the 12 mark, and then your hour hand is a 10 mark to the 12, and your minute hand is 9.5 from the 12, which makes 19.5 twice.
When you drop out the zero. So messages, yep, to be real have got to be redundant, because noise is not. Noise is random. So we have here on Trump's watches, and it's on all the watches, all the different
models.
It's
on all the watches.
The press, you know, ads all refer to these times. There's two different times. One is 10:09. The other is 10:10. And then you look at the second hand and the minute hand and the hour hand. In other words, the watches are screaming over and over again, 19.5, 19.5. And that, of course, is the physics. And what did we do? What did the Enterprise mission, the other side of midnight, do? When Trump came into office as President of the United States, through a back channel that had known him for 40 years, another billionaire in New York City, we gave him a three-hour video on our work, primarily on the incredible ruins on the moon, on Mars, correlations in history, the physics. We gave him the whole picture. And then suddenly, as we're counting down to something, and I'm going to introduce Georgia, because when I ran this by Georgia, she said, wait a minute, that's a countdown. 10, 9, and then you fill in 8, 7. So we're all counting down to something, and Trump knows totally, or his system, his group, his campaign, his bevy of collaborators, and maybe him himself, because I think he has been so misrepresented and underrepresented, and it's all an act, because this is the core of what Trump is doing at this time in our history, and it connects directly to everything we have researched over the last 30, 40 years.
Richard, the gold watch in the middle says Monday the 6th, and the other two watches, the red and the black, are the 28th.
Now, when I saw the 28th and the windows that show what's supposed to be the month and the day, they only show 28. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, 28, what has 28 days in it and is unique for having 28 days? It's February. Oh my gosh, February. That's when Sonny and Butch are coming home. And then if you double 28, you get 56, the orbiting number of Arjuna that was first published. You can't make this stuff.
And 56 goes further, because 56 times 2 is 112. And the Great Pyramid of Egypt is 112, 2.5 cubit staff lengths high. And the 28 is, remember, there's 280 cubits in the height of the Great Pyramid. And you know my coil that I showed today? It's 28 points. It's a 28-pointed coil. So the 28 is deeper, is maybe even deeper, because guess what else about? Okay, so the Great Pyramid is 280 cubits high. Guess how many days a baby stays in the mother's womb? 280, which is full term. So every human is coded with the 28, the 280.
So did Sonny go into orbit pregnant?
No. See, there you go. It's, remember, if you can look this up. I'm not making it up.
No, not at all. All right, look, we only have 10 minutes left, and I want to get everybody a real turn on reacting to the gestalt, the big effing picture, which says, A, the most contentious presidential candidate in United States history is secretly knowing everything we know and obviously more, and is not saying a word, but is doing it in an Emily Dickinson elegant fashion, and all you have to do is look at the damn watches. So let's start with reaction. Greg, you first. Unmute.
Okay. Think.
You're there. Hello?
My machine's slow.
There you are.
I clicked it and I clicked back off again. But anyway, okay. No, I don't have an opinion of that, other than I guess it sounds reasonable that it's all secret code that he's doing.
Well, that gets into motivations. Why wouldn't you simply say all this stuff in plain text?
Oh, no.
No, why would you not? Because obviously somebody doesn't want you to.
Yeah, right.
There's a prescription. There's a gloss. There is an embargo. There is, our model is, we are in prison. We're not supposed to know any of this stuff. And the reason this is so convoluted and through the back door and over the transom and down through the hallway is because it's the only way you can get it past the censors. And who are the censors? And are they the same people who sent two killer hurricanes against the United States to prevent something, and they tried to destroy Cape Canaveral our only public space program during the Milton apparition. And our guys defended and moved the hurricane, which is no mean feat, so that the Cape is fine and it will resume functioning in a few days, and we'll send a spacecraft to Jupiter's moon Europa, the Europa Clipper, to confirm our model of oceans and life in the oceans of Europa, which was supposed to happen on the 10th and will not happen now until next week, because they've got like a month window into November. But it may not have happened at all if they succeeded, the bad guys, in sending a Cat 5 hurricane into the Cape, which is what their original intention was.
Well, you know, that Hera...
that was able to launch just before the hurricane. Okay, we don't have a lot of time.
The hurricane was on the way.
Yeah, it's on its way to the double asteroid. Okay.
Richard, can I come in?
Let me see who I want to... No, David. I want David. And then we'll go to you. Go ahead, David.
I just want to point out that Trump's watch is the 28 plus 28 is the 56, and there are 56 Aubrey hole markers on Stonehenge 1, which means it's tracking. Those markers were tracking the 53 to 56 orbit, in my opinion. So,
and if you go to Greg's tabulation, which was up in my items number six, you'll see that Stonehenge, when Aruna goes into orbit at 19.5, you know, universal time, it's literally at 60 degrees above the northwest horizon, and 60 degrees, of course, is tetrahedral and part of the hyperdimensional modeling equation. None of this can be accident. None of it.
It says from Salisbury Stonehenge, 20 degrees 10 that, below horizon, almost 19.5 degrees. I see what you're saying. So again, there's a connection to Stonehenge again. So again, the 56, the 28 is 56. The Great Pyramid is 280 cubits, which is the 28 times 10. It may be all pointing to tracking of this object. And like you said on the phone with me today, Richard, the date it leaves is November 22nd, the anniversary of Kennedy's assassination and the double 11-11
back to. Okay, Andrew.
Yeah, so with 56, 5 plus 6 is 11.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and Richard, what were the three orbital numbers again? 53, 56, and...
58, 56, and 53.
Right, and Sunny just turned 59. She was 58. And around pregnancy or fertility, it's very quiet about how her and her husband talk about it. She's had some desire to adopt a little girl from India. Their dog, which I think in many ways was kind of like their child, passed away recently, and she talked fondly of it. A dog, Richard?
Serious?
Yes.
And look at how much dogs have suddenly come into the parlance of this insane campaign. Insane! You know, Trump on television saying Haitians, which means voodoo, magic, are eating cats and dogs who are related in Springfield, Ohio. Meme. It's meme city. It's symbolic. They're flying left and right, up and down and back and forth. Okay. And anything else, Andrew?
No, that's it.
Okay. Georgia, you wind us up tonight.
Yeah. 28 is also the natural breath of the Earth, and it is the number of the production and circulation and reabsorption of the spinal fluid in the spine of a human being. So every human being is coded to a 28-day cycle.
Which gets back to having a baby in Earth orbit.
Maybe. Among other things.
Maybe. Okay, we've got 2 minutes. Anybody have any last words? Because the whole...
Well, we have to look at, like, if it's a countdown, is it a countdown to November 22nd approximately or exactly?
Or a countdown to February something.
Well, February is the 28th, the month with 28 days,
okay. Well,
but this year is a leap year.
What we need to do is know, and obviously I didn't have time to do this, one of the watches, the gold watch, has Monday the 6th, right? what year was Monday or is Monday the 6th? And what month?
Okay, that's a good one, yeah. Because the middle one, I mean, geez, who designed these Trump watches?
Well, obviously someone in that group, look, I can't believe for an instant that Trump doesn't know all this. Not for an instant. I don't buy the he's doddering, he's a fool, his weaving is, it's all part of a gestalt to avoid the censors. Remember when you go on Google and insert words, if you type them, they won't let you?
That's right.
And people do all kinds of weird things to avoid the censors. If we have hyperdimensional censors, the folks that put us in prison, and we're being judged by them, and this whole pastiche is basically to get us to the point where we pass our test and get to, you know, live and fight another day. I mean, literally, if you want to look at analogs of bizarre behavior, Trump was shot, or at least that's what we're told, on that first Meridian Butler appearance on July 13th on the 195th day, and then he returns on the 88th day from the end of the year, which is 8 plus 8 and then 6 plus 1. That's a 7. That's more.
That's Mercury. 88 is the orbit of Mercury.
Yes. Yes.
Which?
And Andrew said when we talked about this last night,
yep.
Oh, the sneakers are the shoes of Mercury, and they're gold, and gold is a hyperdimensional metal with the AMU of 195, and we're out of time, everyone.
Oh, no, there's one more thing. There's another comet that will be brighter than Venus on October 28th.
Oh. Oh.
Comet C2024S1 Atlas. Different comet.
Different. Oh, my. I missed that.
It's on starwalk.space right now. At the October 28th, it will be brighter than Venus. They're predicting another comet. Is that the 28th?
To be continued. Hey, I want to thank all my guests tonight, Georgia, David, Andrew, Greg. And all I can say is stay tuned because we're in the middle of this story. We have no idea how it's going to end. Is it going to end? Or is it an inflection point where stunning new things will be beginning? So remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone, and look up. Oh, for God's sake, keep looking up.